the Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very good morning. How are you doing?
Boker Tov. Yes, it's good that people should listen quickly, but I think that that's what the podcast is for, right? You can go back and listen over and over again. And I don't think you can slow it down, but I can think
you can. No, you can speed it up, the podcast, which is great. In fact, I'm enjoying that so much that I'm tempted when I speak to people to try and find a way to speed them up.
It would be good if we could have a technology like that.
Yeah.
And before we get on to speaking about some of the important things, there is a report this morning that apparently alternate Prime Minister Benny Gantz is ready to go to the divorce courts. And apparently there's a rumor that says that the next time he meets Prime Minister Netanyahu, he's going to tell him that the marriage is over.
Wow.
And effectively, that could send us to an election.
I actually can't. I actually can't, Anthony. On a Wednesday.
We've had enough of elections for this year, haven't we?
Yeah. It's just like a natural, it's a national pastime, elections in Israel.
Well, it has been recently, unfortunately. But I have to be honest and say that whereas the last time we went to elections, most Israelis were exasperated by the idea of another election. I think now the mood is different. I think actually people would quite welcome the opportunity to go to an election. I've no idea what the election would result in that would be different from today. I mean, if we believe the opinion polls, we know that Naftali Bennett would be much stronger than he has been. We know that Gantz would be a lot weaker than he has been up until now, that the Likud would also be weaker. But, you know, so much time has passed since those last opinion polls, at least a week or two. And so one doesn't really know what would happen next. It's very, very uncertain, to be honest, what an election might produce.
Mm. Yeah, indeed. Besides fatigue and just an mm-hmm. immense amount of frustration. Big news yesterday, of course, which was the death of Palestinian chief negotiator Saeb Erekat. He died, of course, as we know, from a COVID-19. What has the reaction been like in Israel? Because you see an incredible amount of different coverage, people trying to hold back maybe a little bit considering he's passed away. Give us the sense, how is he going to be remembered?
Well, Saeb Erekat was unfortunately one of these guys who had a job that never ever seemed over the years that he was involved, he never seemed to achieve very much. Because as the chief negotiator, which is a title that he carried for many, many years until his death, he didn't really seem to make much progress with these dreaded negotiations. It was kind of almost like a poison chalice that he had to carry because obviously his ability to negotiate was somewhat limited by the environment in which he was negotiating, both on the side of the Israeli government and as well as on the side of the Palestinian Authority. Let's not forget that he was there sitting beside Yasser Arafat when they met with the Clinton administration. He's been around the houses a few times. He's seen a bit of action, even though he was only 65 at the time of his death yesterday. But he had certainly been around the houses a few times and he'd been involved in many political negotiations. And the way that he had generally expressed himself about Israel was never in positive terms. He never seemed to give any respect to Israel, to the Israeli government, to the party that he was negotiating with in order to try and achieve an outcome. He was always highly critical. He always had many negative criticisms to voice about Israel, about how Israel was behaving. Whereas behind the scenes, in all fairness, there was quite a lot of cooperation. There has been a lot of cooperation. But of course, one chooses what one publicizes in order to try to present a certain position. And Erekat's position was always a little bit of a nemesis situation with Israel, that he never really gave any credit or any respect to things that went on the Israeli side. So it's highly ironic that ultimately it was an Israeli hospital that was fighting to save his life until yesterday. Obviously, not a very well man at all. He'd undergone a lung transplant already a few years ago, and that didn't help his cause when he contracted COVID-19. He was being taken care of in the intensive care unit of Hadassah Hospital. His doctor was very outspoken in saying that he was provided with every treatment possible, and that he believes, in the words of the doctor, Dr. Vernon van Heerden, he believes that the team went above and beyond in all efforts to try to save Saeb Arakat. And we know that it was his family who requested that he be transported to an Israeli hospital after he became very, very ill. And of course, every kind of rumor could persist about whether Israel had it in their interests to indeed save his life and to fight for his life, or whether the opposite might be true. I was certainly expecting accusations to come out saying, well, Israel didn't really take proper care of him, and this was all done on purpose, you know, along the lines of what we heard after the Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat passed away back in 2004. There were lots of conspiracy theories about Israel being involved in his death. But I think that genuinely the hospital did everything that they could in order to make him comfortable, in order to try to save his life. Ultimately, they were unable to do so. I think, unfortunately, for Saeb Arakat, that the job that he was given to do was never really achieved, and that may well be his legacy. There were some Israeli politicians who came out to eulogize him in very positive terms, particularly Tzipi Livni and Ehud Olmert had a lot of good things to say about him, how he presented the Palestinian cause. But I think that the best thing that he could have potentially achieved for the Palestinian cause was to succeed in those negotiations and to somehow come to some sort of an agreement, which was something, unfortunately, that he never managed to do in his lifetime.
Tell us about Jonathan Pollard.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the rumors about Jonathan Pollard are ongoing, but they've now surfaced again very, very strongly. Jonathan Pollard, for those who don't recall, was jailed by the U.S. By the U.S. Supreme Court, U.S. court, for spying on behalf of Israel. He at the time was working for the U.S. government. I think he was in the Navy at the time, had access to very secret information, and was found guilty of passing the secret information to the Israeli government. He was being obviously managed by the Mossad. And that story is quite a famous story, the secrets that he passed to Israel. There was a lot of, talk about whether he deserved to have been jailed for so long, given that the secrets that were being passed to a friendly country rather than to an enemy country of the United States. I think a lot of the story still hasn't come out in the open because successive U.S. governments, in spite of the Israeli government's attempts to try to have him freed from the very, very lengthy jail sentence that he had to serve, the successive U.S. governments and the U.S. courts were unwilling to free him or allow him any sort of time off from his prison sentence. Such was the serious nature of the crimes that he committed, according to the way that the U.S. government analyzed it. But he was finally released in 2015 from prison, and he's been living since then under very, very stringent conditions, very strict conditions in the city of New York. He's not allowed to go anywhere. He's under a nighttime curfew. He's not allowed to hold down a job. He's being constantly followed by the U.S. security services to make sure that he, doesn't transgress these restrictions. He's got some sort of an electronic tag, I understand, which he's forced to go around with all the time. And once again, Prime Minister Netanyahu intervened on his behalf to request that he be allowed to live outside of the New York area. In particular, apparently, he wants to make Aliyah, and he wants to come and live in Israel, and he's not been allowed to do so. Now, apparently, the five-year probation period under which he was operating is due to end next week. And so now we're into this sort of what they call the lame duck period in the U.S., where the president is effectively being defeated, and he has another 10 or so weeks in which he can do whatever he likes. He's still the president. He still has the powers to do so. But he can do things which don't have consequences for him. He can take actions and make decisions, which then will become the problem of the next administration. And this is the period of time when many, many things, strange things have been known to happen under previous presidencies. People have been pardoned and released from jail and all kinds of very serious decisions taken, which of course don't have any consequences for the current president. And so one understands that President Trump potentially has the opportunity to do exactly that. This is not one of those cases, though, because if Jonathan Pollard's restrictions are not renewed next week, then he effectively will be free from his probation period. And so it's not one of those things where President Trump actually has to take an action. He just has to be inactive. Yeah, he doesn't have to do anything. And in theory, Jonathan Pollard would then be free to make Aliyah, which apparently he wishes to do along with his wife, Anne. So it's going to be interesting to see how that all pans out during the course of next week when those restrictions are due to be lifted.
Yeah, fascinating. It'll be interesting to see what happens. This is just an amazing story, but no surprise. Israel's Weizmann Institute has been ranked the eighth in the world for quality research. Just tell us about it. What gives the Weizmann Institute its advantage?
Well, the Weizmann Institute is a fascinating institution. It was actually founded back in 1934, even before the founding of the State of Israel, by former President Chaim Weizmann, who of course was a scientist, and he set up founding it with a team of a few research scientists, very, very well-known ones. And the Weizmann Institute has constantly been a beacon of light, an absolute great example of Israeli capability and Israeli scientific knowledge. It has numerous Nobel Prize winners who have come out of there, and also Turing Prize winners. So it's really done very, very well over the years. And this, the latest accolade that it's managed to achieve, comes as no surprise. Because the quality of the research coming out of Weizmann has always been very good. And this, the latest accolade, comes from the Leiden University in the Netherlands, which has published, list of, institutions, research institutions. It's the Center for Science and Technology Studies at Leiden University. And on this occasion, Weizmann has been ranked eighth globally for research quality. And there's only one other non-US institution in the list of the top 10 on that particular list, which is Shandong University in China, which was ranked number 10. So in other words, all the first seven and the ninth are all US institutions. But as we said, you know, this is no surprise for Weizmann. They've been ranked fourth in a sub-ranking of life and earth sciences. And previously also on the same Leiden list, the Leiden ranking, they've also been ranked very, very highly indeed. I think last year they were ranked ninth. And they've also been ranked second globally for research quality by the Nature Index, which was last year. So overall, high accolades for the Weizmann Institute, which carries the name of our former president, the first president, Chaim Weizmann.
Amazing. Absolutely incredible, and something really to be very, very proud of. It is 8 o'clock. This is where we have to leave it. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning at the same time.